This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
There are so many people who have so much brilliance in their heads that will never get it out unless it's very easy for them, right? That's literally why our company exists. That's why we call it Scribe, is literally because Socrates was a brilliant, genius man. No one would know who he is if it weren't for his scribe.
Right, because he didn't write a single thing.
He didn't write none of it down.
You made this great point. What if somebody just wants to have five readers, their great-grandchildren? And why can't they write their book? Like, I wish my great-great-grandfather wrote a book where his only audience would have been me.
Yep. Every day, millions of people die with all this genius and wisdom and knowledge locked up in their heads, and it doesn't get out, and it dies with them. It's kind of funny. We've been talking about this for 30 minutes, but this isn't even my fight.
No, but yeah. I would say it is a little bit because with Scribe Media, I'll just describe a little bit what you do. Your point is many people have stories. Many people don't have the skills or time to write their stories. Let's say the best surgeon in the world, he's busy saving his lives.
Right.
He's never put in the 10,000 hours it requires to be
Tiffany
a good
Haddish
writer.
Tiffany is actually the best example ever.
Yeah, this Tiffany Haddish is like
Tiffany
a brilliant
came
comedian.
From nothing. Foster care, the worst stuff. Go, you want to see what books do. You don't have to read Tiffany Haddish's book. Go look at the reviews. She has 2,000 reviews on Amazon. I think she has over 30,000 reviews on Audible because her audience are mostly young urban youth, right? Especially girls. They listen, they don't read, cool. Go look at her Audible reviews. Go read them. If you aren't crying by page two, you don't have a heart. Every other review is a 13-year-old black girl saying things like, I had no idea this was possible. I had no idea real celebrities came from where I came from and had all these other issues too. I had no idea.
Right. This so and existed. She wasn't necessarily going to get published by the mainstream until she was a superstar.
Right, she wasn't.
You guys were working with her
we came in
right
early.
Before superstardom.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think your point is basically people should have a platform to express their story instead of being chosen by a gatekeeper. It's a very, what I would call, choose yourself kind of company.
Yes.
You could basically 100%. Decide, I want to write a book for my own reasons and not because some other publisher wants to take 90% of the profits off of my name.
Yes.
And publish only the story. I like one time, and it's horrible dealing with mainstream publishers. One time I wrote a book and an editorial, I made a comment about climate change that an assistant to an assistant of the editor didn't agree with. They would not publish the book unless I changed this one comment. I didn't change the comment. They did publish the book because they had already advertised it to bookstores. But just the fact that I had to deal with that, I presented like a million articles on both sides, actually, saying that both sides are legit. There's super scientists like Bill Gates on one side, you know, and his scientists, another big guy on this other side and their scientists. All I was doing was presenting that there's two sides to the story. And they were so upset. So your point is look, tell your story. We'll help you make it the best possible story. We'll help you get customers. We'll help you understand the publishing business because it's kind of complicated. And that's the service you perform for your customers.
Yes.
That's why Tiffany comes to you. That's why Nassim Taleb, who's published major bestsellers with major publishing companies, comes to you.
Mm-hmm. He wants to own the rights to his book. He wants to control everything. So he works with us.
Right. So on an economic level too, it makes sense. People don't realize it though. People think there's a stigma to publishing this way. But if I hold up a book to somebody who says this to me and I say, okay, tell me who published this book.
No one
knows the name of any publisher.
Actually, you know what's funny? Self-publishing, 30 years ago used to be called vanity publishing. I actually think traditional publishing is now vanity publishing. Because if you go with traditional, the reason is because you feel like you need that external validation from a publishing company. That's the vanity now.
Right.
When you can publish the exact same book, in fact, usually better. You work with a company like us, or you even do it yourself. I mean, God knows we're not the only way to do it. But you can do a better book by yourself and you can own everything. Or you can go give up 85% to 95% or whatever to a publisher. They don't do anything other than put their name on the spine and confer, and I'm saying this in quotes if you're listening, credibility. It's bullshit.
That's the only credibility thing, because they don't get you in bookstores.
No.
They don't get you on bestseller lists.
Nope.
They have no marketing
no
ability.
No marketing. None.
And by the way, the best editors are independently editing.
They work for us. The best editors work for us.
Right. Well, I use Neil Parker for Choose Yourself.
Yeah. We pay more.
So it's interesting though, because the stigma, the gatekeeper thing is so powerful. Like, people want to be liked by someone with higher status.
The emperor has no clothes, man.
Yeah.
When the emperor is naked, you're not going to, who's going to be the one to say that?
And there's another great point you made. I heard you give in a talk in 2014, which always stuck with me, which is that, and I'm going to extend it a little bit. Publishers, their definition of success is if your book sells a lot of copies in the first 2 weeks, they'll be your friend.
Yeah.
That's their only agenda.
Yeah.
But, and I say that not being degrading to them. That's
their business model.
That's their business model, and that's fine. And I've dealt with it. We've all dealt with it. But you made this great point. What if somebody just wants to have 5 readers, their great grandchildren, and why can't they write their book? Like, I wish my great great grandfather wrote a book where his only audience would have been me.
Yep.
But in today's world, we think a book can't be written for that purpose because that's what we've been trained. No, Random House won't publish that. Barnes & Noble won't share it. But that's a totally valid reason to write a book as well.
Of course it is. Absolutely. That's why JT came to us, right? He wanted, he didn't think anyone would care about his story. He just wanted to tell his story to his kids because, you know, JT's got all the money in the world now. He's afraid his kids are going to grow up rich, entitled, spoiled brats in the suburbs. He wanted to make sure they knew where they came from. Right. But then it turns out the book's amazing. He's got an incredible story. Everyone wants to hear it. Yeah, absolutely, dude. I mean, we're getting there. We're not at the point yet where we've created a platform where anyone can come in for almost any price and have access to really great tools to tell their story yet. like in software or whatever, we have a book that walks through our exact process. So anyone who wants to do it can do it. The tools are out there. But no, our goal eventually is so that, here's the thing, you're conflicting two things. Having a platform.
Why am I always wrong?
You're not wrong. You're just putting two things together. Having a platform upon which to distribute your voice is a different thing than having help understanding what your voice is and getting it into a medium. You know, they're two different things, right?
I agree with that.
So like getting good at a podcast and then putting it on iTunes are different things, right? Okay. So the fight that we spent 30 minutes talking about, you know, the Jordan Peterson, Alex Jones being deplatformed fight, right? That is not my fight. That is a very important fight. Other people are fighting that, really smart, accomplished people. I think eventually all of the distributed platforms are eventually going to become undistributed. And so you're going to have a YouTube and a Twitter and a whatever that are, I don't know if it's going to be run off blockchain or whatever, but they're essentially totally decentralized so that they'll be as close as possible to pure free speech platforms. There are problems with that. I'm not exactly sure how problems are going to be solved, but I think that's where we're going to go, is that we live in a world now where authoritarian control doesn't work anymore. The genie is now out of the bottle. And so
it's a battle.
It is 100% a battle, and it is maybe the defining battle of the next 20 years, is do we let governments and authoritarians on either right or left control means of distribution, or do we let the people? I sound like fucking Karl Marx, but it's true, man. I'm a Chicago school economist, but that is maybe the defining battle, because I think the genie's out of the bottle too far, though. And I think all the mainstream media and all those people are playing the status tribal games of the last war. They're fighting the old war. All that's doing is creating the antibodies to that faster and faster. And there are too many smart people who have too much money and too much power on the other side now. And so we are getting slowly but surely to a freer world and platform-wise. But that is essentially at its core a tech fight. That is not my fight. My skills are a different place. Because now imagine that war's won, right? Imagine today, I snap my fingers, the war's won, everyone has access, any platform they want, et cetera, et cetera. Cool. There, I feel like the war after that is the knowledge in people's head and the wisdom in their head, getting it into a medium that other people can understand and relate to and consume.
Okay, so let me ask you about this, because we both know we know 1,000 people who have written books for their own agendas. Like they don't necessarily want to write the best book, but they want consulting gigs, they want speaking gigs, they want business opportunities.
That's a huge number of our clients.
Right, and there's nothing wrong with that. The problem I have with that category is that most of those people are horrible writers, don't respect writing as a craft you have to work at.
Agreed.
And the books are just horrible.
That's why they work with us.
And so I think those people should work with you. I feel like the next war is explaining to people you need to step up your game in terms of learning this craft.
Yeah, no, I disagree. I actually fundamentally disagree, man. That's like, you know what that sounds like an auto mechanic saying, like, how can you really drive a car unless you know how to build an engine?
All right.
That's bullshit.
All right.
I disagree.
Fair enough. Well, I think the problem is these people think that they're good writers and they're publishing
the
books.
You're talking about people who are writing the book themselves with no help because they think because they're good at their field, they're going to be good at writing. I totally agree with that. Writing is a very distinct, very different craft from being an expert at something. That's literally why our company exists. That's why we call it Scribe, is literally because Socrates was a brilliant, genius man who set the foundation for Western culture in many ways. No one would know who he is if it weren't for Plato. If it weren't for his scribe.
Right, because he didn't write a single
thing. He didn't write none of it down, right? That's the difference, is I feel like there are so many people who have so much brilliance in their heads that will never get it out unless it's very easy for them, right? They don't necessarily have to work with another person. I feel like we can create our process so that it becomes very low friction and you kind of do it. I don't want to say automated, but it's very much a do-it-yourself way. I think as we build the tech, you know, I'm in this to win this, man. This is a 20, 30, 40-year company for me. So we'll get there eventually. But we're starting right now with the most successful people on earth who have done immense amount, who've made money from it, which are not the only people who have things to say at all, but we got to start somewhere, right? Like iPhones, you know, set the category. Now 3 billion people have smartphones. We're doing the same thing. We're setting the category, and eventually I want our service to be available to literally everyone. But the point is, every day, millions of people die with all this genius and wisdom and knowledge locked up in their heads, and it doesn't get out, and it dies with them. And that, there is, all civilization is the compounding of wisdom. That's it. You and I are sitting, you can't tell me how those lights work, or this camera, or this microphone. These work because geniuses before us figured this out. And then the knowledge became institutionalized as part of our, it became a commodity, right? But too little of that happens. Like the example I always use is the Library of Alexandria. The Egyptians were a culture of scribes, and they wrote everything down. Alexandria was the most important trading port for most of what we would consider the BC time, like pre-Jesus, right? And a little bit even in after. But every ship that came in, the rule in the port was if you had a scroll or anything written down, you had to give it to the scribes and they would copy it and then give it back to you, right? And so the Library of Alexandria had every piece of written wisdom in the world. And they would send scribes out to like sit with people like Socrates or whoever the geniuses at the time were and write down what they were saying. They were obsessed with writing things down. That was their thing. And then Cleopatra had a fight with Caesar and Caesar burned it to the ground and the world lost all of that wisdom that was not written down. And that didn't cause us to fall into a dark ages, but once the Roman Empire fell, we went into a dark ages because none of that knowledge was recorded anywhere else. Well, you realize in the last 30 years, we figured out how the Romans made the concrete they did that keeps aqueducts up for 2,000 years. We figured out about 30 years ago how the pyramids were built, which are 5,000 years old, right? All of this wisdom was lost. All civilization is the compounding of wisdom. I feel like this is maybe the most important long-term fight we have is what we're doing. The platform fight's a different fight, though. Like, if I have my way and we have our way at Scribe, no one dies with anything in their head that someone else in the future will want
to
know.
Well, and I think, you know, not to kind of just suddenly take the conversation immediately to the practical that everyone could take advantage of, but I think you having such a historical motivation for a business, you know, it's a motivation that stretches thousands of years. This is a good reason to start a business. I think, you know, and let's take the opposite end. Oh, I want to make $1 million in the next year. That's the opposite end of that, of the reason you should start a business. That's the bad reason to start. In my opinion, you won't succeed.
Yeah, if you don't care about the problem at all, then you're not going to succeed.
Right. So solving, you know, and a lot of people say, oh, if you help 1 billion people, you'll make $1 billion. I don't necessarily believe that either. I think the most important thing is having a vision that is so ingrained in everything you've done over the past 2 decades.
Yes.
That's a great reason to start a business. And then having you know, customers who buy into that vision, which clearly they do, having a CEO who bought into that vision, he did his book through you. I think that's critical. You have a great culture at the business. Everybody is like lifers at your business. I've known them for ever since they started working for you, you know, years and years and years ago. What's the next, like Jay, you just said, you stepped down as CEO, JT stepped up because people would follow you, but people would like die for JT.
Yeah.
What does JT bring in terms of motivation on top of that supports the vision that you just laid out? Because I think that's a very practical skill that business mentioned.
It's a great question. All right. So here's this is actually going to be hard for me to say because it makes me realize things about myself that aren't necessarily the most pleasant. But if I'm going to be all about the truth, then I got to do it even when it's not palatable. I think people love JT because he loves them back. Hmm. Like great leader loves the people that they lead and they put them first. And he is a master at that. And I feel like I am not. It's not that I don't care about them. He's far, 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 far farther along on that path than I am.
What do you think internally did that for him, particularly given his background?
I don't know, man. I don't know. It's a good question. You're going to have to ask him when he's on the podcast.
When is he in the city? See him coming to the city. He's busy in Austin.
Yeah, right. He's busy. I know he's coming, I think, later this year. So, of course, I'll make sure that you talk to him because you two will love each other. But the reason our tribe loves him so much is because they know he loves them. And it's not just, oh, yeah, it's not. Most companies are like, oh, we care about our people. It's all mouth. It's all word. It's all bullshit. It's not bullshit with JT. It's real with him. Like, every single person in our company can tell you a story about how JT – they've seen him either love them or other people or both, and all the stories are going to be different. It's not like there's a mythology of JT. It's personal. Like he really cares at the core of his soul.
So I think these two things, like having an outward facing vision that you truly like deeply believe in, and it's got a historical foundation and it's true. Like if you think about it, you know, there was the Gutenberg press, which allowed basically anybody to write.
Anyone then, to print at scale is right. What it was.
And then I think there's this brief period where publishers would help and bookstores would help with distribution. And I think that era is dying. But then the combination of a mega platform like Amazon making it easy to distribute, plus companies like yours making it easy to take an enormous skill set and translate that into something that's readable. I think this is, and I'm not just saying this to build you up. I think that's like the next step after the Gutenberg press. Finally, people could, once again, say what they believe in, communicate it in a way that's effective, and distribute it. You know, and now look, some people don't need you. If you have the skills of writing,
yeah, no,
if you
do can it
get
yourself,
a cover
great,
designer.
No problem.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but again, you know, someone who's been a heart surgeon for 50 years, they're not going to have the 10,000 hours to build the writing craft.
Exactly. Or it doesn't even make sense for them to. Like,
they're busy saving
above
lives.
Above a certain amount that you make, it doesn't make sense for you to even manage the process even if you could, because you're taking time away from what you're great at to spend time at even something, even if you're good at it. I mean, that's just the basic law of comparative advantage. That's basic economics. If you make, I'm just make up numbers, if you make $100 an hour even, it makes no sense not to hire us because if you spend your time doing the book yourself, it's costing you $100 an hour, and you can hire us effectively for less than that at a per hour cost, right? So it makes zero sense for you not to hire us or somebody, but even though we're the best.
But let's look at a guy though like Nassim Taleb, who's a great writer. He's not using you for...
No, he's not using... So we have a publishing arm. So you can come to us with just your idea, and then we have like a whole interview process that takes you all the way through, and we do all the work. I mean, it's like, it's 36 grand now, total turnkey. It's kind of like ghostwriting, but it's not ghostwriting, because ghostwriting is like where someone's writing their idea of your book. This is a full interview process. It is your ideas in your words and your voice. Then once the manuscript is done, then we do all the publishing. Or you can come to us with a finished book, like you've written it yourself. Cool, no problem. We do all the publishing. So that's, Nassim is not at all in any way, shape, or form doing our sort of our full process. Like it wouldn't make sense for you either.
No,
you're
a sense,
both writers.
In a sense, I was like a alpha version, yes, of your company.
Choose Yourself absolutely was the alpha version.
Because yeah. I wrote the book and then you helped me with the editing, the cover design, interior design.
We did all of it.
And then
right.
Even the formatting for Kindle and CreateSpace, and You gave me advice. Choose Yourself's the first book I did as an audiobook, because you said, A, you have to do an audiobook, and I followed your advice and it was great. And B, you literally called my ex-wife and said, don't let James just read it in his bathroom or whatever, yeah, like use the
studio
and do it professionally, yeah, and that kind of made an impression on me in the sense that if you're going to do something, make every aspect of it professional,
yes,
and then you're still doing it yourself,
yes,
but do it with the highest possible quality in every way. That's why for this podcast, for instance, we're doing it in person, because I think that's more
you've
professional
got great
than
mics,
Skype.
You've got a whole team here.
Yeah,
fantastic.
We're videotaping it. We're miking it. The audio quality is going to be great. We're doing it in a professional studio.
Yep.
Semi-professional studio. This is my stand-up club.
Yeah, right. Of course.
So,
yeah.
But we have podcast studios in here. So doing everything professionally, I feel like I was like the alpha version of your,
yes, 100%
of what you did.
Yes, 100%.
So, and then, I don't know, I guess I just wanted to boil it down to like, you're still, you know, 20 years later, engaged heavily in the writing process. People should just read one chapter of any of your books just to see an example of what good writing is. But what would you say for you are the top three rules of writing?
This is what we tell our authors. Like we now have a program actually called Guided Author, where it's the exact same process for the 36 grand. But instead of us doing all the manuscript work for you, we tell you what to do and then you do it, right? And with our guidance. So it's like a third less, but you're going to have your hands on the keyboard, but you're going to have total guidance. And then when you finish, we do all the publishing, right? So like people love this now. This is because there are some people who are just like, okay, you do, it's my knowledge. I'm going to get on the phone with you. I'm going to dump my soul into the calls, but then you do everything else. And there are people who like just want to do it themselves. Great, no problem. There's a middle tier who want a lot of guidance and a lot of help, but they do want their fingers on the keyboard, right? And so those people are perfect for Guided Author. Anyway, so I'll tell you what I tell those people. The number one rule, there's three things. This is literally our positioning. This is our structure, how we do it. The first thing you have to understand is what are you trying to accomplish with this book or this piece of writing? What is your goal? Because if you don't know why you're writing it, you're just going to write meandering nonsense, right? So, and I don't mean, part of your goal can be, you know, the impact you want the book to create in the world. That's cool and important. But you should also be thinking about what do you want this book to create for you? Right.
What do you mean? What's an example?
Okay. So if I'm a consultant, if I'm a CEO coach, right? Mm-hmm. And I coach, you know, Fortune 1000 CEOs, I'm doing this book because I want to raise my, I'm already the expert. I already coach a bunch of CEOs, but no one kind of knows except the guys I coach. So, or the women and men. So I want this book to kind of show the world to establish my authority in this space and credibility, to show the world I know what I'm talking about, right? And to show that it's not about bragging. It's about here's what I do. Here's my knowledge. It's about here's my knowledge and wisdom so that I have the authority and credibility in my space. I want this book to be kind of the hook for media. So it raises my visibility. So, you know, it's easy for me to get speaking gigs. It's easy for me to go on podcasts. Like, if I'm the best CEO coach in the world, you're not having me probably on your podcast. But if I have the book that is the definitive CEO coaching book, you're probably going to have me on your podcast now. So it's a authority, visibility, and then also it's a legacy piece for me. Like I've done amazing work. Like I've helped all these companies, these CEOs do well, which help these companies do well. I kind of want, you know, my friends, family, whatever to know I've produced real value in the world.
So, you know, you're saying this is the number one.
And I'm not a fucking CEO coach. I'm the worst. Right.
So you're saying though this though as a rule for writing. How does this translate into better writing?
So hold on. You got to stick with me now because once you know what you're trying to accomplish, right? Whereas you and I write for entertainment, right? Or my old stuff was right. I want to make people laugh. Totally different than establishing authority and credibility. Just different right. goals. But you must understand what your goal is. What is your objective with this book? Because once you know your objective, now you know who your audience is, right? So if my goal is to establish authority with CEOs of Fortune 1000 companies, my audience are CEOs of Fortune 1000 companies and the people that influence them. That's right. My only audience.
So that can motivate, let's say the first line of a book like that is, your billion-dollar revenue company is about to go bankrupt. The bank is on the phone. You're scared to death and you're hiding under the table.
If you're James Altucher, that's the first line.
I walked in and
we start talking about it, right.
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, "Good things come to those who wait." I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important, and I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
So now you know who your audience is, right? So in your case, let's say you want to do a book on how cryptocurrency is the future of money. You want to like establish your authority in that space. You want to help people understand that, all that kind of stuff. So then your audience are people who are interested in crypto, people who are looking for other investments. Like, you see what I'm saying? Of course.
Right.
So number one is, what are your objectives? Number two is, who is your audience? That gets you to the third thing. Notice I haven't talked about what the idea for the book is. Everyone wants to start there, but that's about them. The third thing is, why will your audience care? Because no one cares about your book. No one. They only care about themselves, and they care about what your book will do for them. So for the CEO example, the answer is, if I'm the CEO of a Fortune 1000 company, I'm only going to care about your book if I think you're going to help me learn things and get better at my job. Same with you. Someone, the only reason anyone's going to care about your crypto book is because you're going to help them figure out crypto so that they can make more money and be ready for the future or whatever, right? Invest in or whatever. So if you get all three of those, now it all dovetails, right? Because once you understand your objectives, then you know who your audience is. Now you know what you have to write about, right? Now you know how to frame it too. The big problem that most writers make is they approach the book from their own perspective. But no one cares about you, and they don't care about your book. They only care about what your book will do for them. What our process does, the process I just detailed to you, it helps you clearly identify why an audience will care for your book, and it helps you write to that. So that, because if you do not write this book in service of an audience, it will not get you any benefits at all. It will probably flop because there's so much content and there's so many alternatives now. Why would someone read something that's not about them?
I think that's a really good point that I want to get back to. I also think the most important thing you said there is, nobody cares about you or your book.
Yes.
Because I think all your rules fall out of that principle.
Yes.
Which is that everybody has a self-inflated view of like why people should care about them. You have to actually build the argument.
Well,
in the
you
book.
Know, here's what's crazy. So we walk so many, we've done this, you know, we've worked with 1,000 authors now or something. So we've done this so much. But everyone starts off, people who don't know books, right? They start off being like, they think they kind of want to write a book about themselves or about all the cool things they've done. And so what we always do is we kind of run them through this process, and what they realize, we talk them around to understanding that the book has to be positioned for the audience. And they get that. Most everyone gets that, and they understand why, and they understand the logic once we kind of walk them through it. But they think in their minds there's a dichotomy between either the book's about me or the book's about my readers. Not true. The best books are positioned for the reader, meaning like basically here is what you're going to learn. Here is the benefit for you, right? But that's kind of like sell them what they want, right? You sell them the benefit. But the actual book itself has tons of your own stories in it. The reason is because now all those stories are in service of teaching them what they want to know and delivering the benefit. The stories aren't about, they could be totally about you, but every story is relevant to something they're learning. The reason is because, number one, humans learn through story much better than they learn any other way. So if you can tell a story that it makes your point, they're going to learn it and they're going to read it and they're stay engaged. And two is people will then connect with you and they will care about you. You are a master at this, at teaching relatively complex or relatively straightforward things, teaching information through story. That's what you do. That's why you are who you are. That's why millions of people are going to listen to this podcast, is because you don't lecture people. You don't just lay out the information. You give it to them in the context of a story that they can understand and relate to. So really what we do with almost everybody is we take them and reframe them from this book's about me to this book's about the audience, but I will teach the audience through stories about me.
And then, but then the craft of storytelling, there's got to be like what's...
Oh yeah, dude, that's deeply difficult. It's one of those, it is extraordinarily deep and difficult and intense. So, but there's actually, it's one of the, I give our sort of guided author people, if you go to describe and you're turnkey, you don't really have to learn it so much because we have master writers and storytellers and editors who essentially do it for you. But if you're writing it yourself, here's the hack that we teach people. So the way you want to think about, don't think about telling a story, right? Because if you try to learn story structure, it's ridiculously complex and you will get lost in the weeds as a novice or as an amateur. But the way you can kind of hack it and get close to being a professional with very, very little work is to think of your book as, I'm going to teach a friend of mine who is ignorant of this knowledge. Not stupid, they're just ignorant, right? I am going to teach them this. So that structure makes you forces structure. Okay, where am I going to start? What's the second thing I'm going to teach? What's the third thing? What's the fourth thing? Then it forces you to only tell stories that are relevant. Like imagine I'm sitting across the table from a friend, like you are a friend. Imagine I'm going to teach you about something you care about, right? That I know about. You know, like being a parent. I mean, you're a parent more than I am, but like, let's just take that as an example.
I might be a bad parent, so.
I don't know if I'm good either, but it's an easy example, right? So let's say you don't have kids, you're about to have kids. So I'm gonna say, all right, James, you need to start here. And then I'm gonna like, you know, whatever it is, understanding the parenting's about the kid, not about you or something. And then I'm gonna like kind of tell you the facts, and then I'm gonna tell you like one or two stories, right? Because if you come to me and ask me, that's how I'm gonna say, well, you need to know this and this, fact one and fact two. And like the way I learned fact one is, and then tell the story. And the way I learned fact two is, and then tell the story, right? If you just do that, you are going to have a very, very good book.
Right, if you just say the facts without the stories, no one's listening.
No.
Because you're right.
It doesn't land anywhere. It doesn't connect.
Right. It's a primal, almost biological thing that we tell through storytelling. I just wanted to add one thing to that, which is often when I'm writing a book, it's not like, oh, I'm such an expert, so I'm going to tell you all these great stories. I'm kind of learning myself while I'm writing the book. I'm having stories while I'm writing the book. Like, I didn't write the book Choose Yourself because I was so great at, like, avoiding the gatekeepers. It's because I felt my whole life like I needed to be validated by them. And it was a disaster, was a result. And I'm in the middle of a disaster. And so writing the book is almost my processing that disaster. Yes. That's the story. So that's where it is the story of me a little bit, but it's using 100%. It to kind of say, okay, here's how here's a state that many of us are in, being stuck because the gatekeepers blocked us. Here's how I got out of it you could use my advice or not. I'm not being a lecturer. Yeah. I'm just telling my story.
You know what's so funny, man? In the guided author, so the way guided author works is that everyone in the program comes to Austin for 2 days, and they spend 2 days with me and two of my senior team. And it's not individual, like we'll do it in cohorts where it's basically a 4-to-1 ratio. So there's at least four authors to one sort of editor. So like, you know, 12 people will be me and two senior editors, right? And so we walk them through the positioning, kind of like that's the beginning of our positioning process. And then we walk them through, we build the entire outline with them. We do the writing schedule, all that sort of stuff. So when they leave, they know exactly what they're writing, when they're writing, all that. They got it all dialed in. They just have to go home and write, okay? And then, of course, we have, you know, ongoing support when they go home and weekly calls and all that stuff. But here's what's funny is you just, and it makes total sense because you're a writer and you get it. I always end the workshop with why your book matters. And so for each person, I give like not even a 5-minute speech, a 2-minute speech about why their book matters. And what's so funny is I would say almost every 95% of people, here's the narrative of the book is they had a real problem in their life. They figured out a way to solve it. Now they're bringing that wisdom to other people who have that problem. Even if they're doing the book for business, 100% for business, that's still the narrative.
Well, what's funny there is what you just described.
That's the hero's journey.
It's the hero's journey on top of the hero's journey.
Right.
So they already had the hero's journey, which is their problem. Now they have what our friend Steve Pressfield calls the artist journey, which is like, how do you take the hero's journey to express your prior hero's journey?
Exactly right. So like an iconic example is this woman, Anita, who came through and she's a sales consultant, like really high end. She's an amazing sales trainer. She was like she's this small little Indian woman and very demure and whatever. And she got into sales and was terrible at it and like had struggled with it and was going to whatever, all this sort of stuff. And then she taught herself sales. She got really good at it and like amazing at it, right? And so she was kind of like the iconic sort of tech person, right? Terrible at dealing with people, whatever. She got amazing at it, became a baller salesperson, and then realized that she had a skill. She could teach tech people how to become salespeople. Mm. And so so she became a consultant. She's really good at it. Now she wants to level up and be seen as the sales trainer for tech people, right? And she told me this story about this guy, Antonio, that like basically was not, like he couldn't feed his family. He was in sales, kind of a nerdy, like bad with people tech person, was failing, was not even feeding his family. And he was one of her first clients, and she turned him around in like a few months. And now the guy is like a top grossing salesperson for some, you know, whatever B2B sales tech company. Right. But he like lives in a great house. His wife's happy. I mean, she literally changed the life of this family. Right. And it's like that. So I never start with hero's journey because then they get it in their head that they get all weird. I walk them through it without telling them what it is. And then at the end, I'm like, now look at what you've done. Now you have the entire template. You have the map to go do your heroes. You did the journey yourself. But that's the whole point of the hero's journey, James, is that when you come back, when you cross this threshold, you go on the adventures, you fight the demon, you get the treasure, right? The treasure then you bring back to the village and share with everyone. That is the whole point.
Right.
So they're in that stage now of you've got the treasure. That's their knowledge. The book is how they bring it back and share it with everyone. Right. That's the thing. And so I walk them through that, and it's like then now they're all excited and they get the book's not, yes, it helps them with business, and yes, that matters a lot, but like they get that there's a purpose beyond them for the book.
So let me ask one step further, which is almost kind of a meta question to your business, which is 10 years from now, where's media heading? Now, think about 10 years ago. You could write a book, like Malcolm Gladwell could write a book and become famous because of that book, and that's it. That doesn't really happen anymore. I mean, the only example I've really seen, honestly, in the past 10 years was Jordan Peterson.
But he didn't become famous because of his book.
No, it's because of his YouTube videos.
Yes.
So, and because
of
controversy. Like, he kind of hitched onto a huge controversy, and that propelled his videos.
He had a huge audience before the book came out.
Right. So, and then you see, I'm going to expand it further. You see Netflix spending $13 billion a year buying new shows. That's going to fail in disaster because nobody has time to watch 200 new shows. There's not even a long tail of that. Like most shows, I get no viewers. So TV is going to change. Book publishing is going to change. Music's already changed. The one social media network with the by far the greatest number of new users is Instagram, which we know is just photograph, like the worst photographs in the world. So what's actually, are we just degenerating into this
splooge of bad media?
No.
That's never how it works, man. Everything runs in cycles. You know that, man. You're a trader. You understand.
Okay, but maybe because I'm so immersed in the middle of it, I'm seeing sort of a big picture, like how everything's kind of changing and failing in weird ways. But where do you see it coming out at the end?
For what media?
For media in general. For you as a person who wants to express a message. For you as a person, a young person can say, oh, Tucker did a blog and then a book and the book was a bestseller. That can't happen anymore. Like even when I had Seth Godin on a few weeks ago and when I had him on a year earlier, every single time he always says year over year, his blog views get cut in half. So like that phenomenon of blog to book is done, for instance. So what's the pathway now of multimedia?
So you got to look at it. You're looking at it too small, mm-hmm. right? You're looking like a finance chart. You know, you zoom down to 3 months and trying to extrapolate. No, you got to zoom out, dude.
Okay.
You got to zoom out to 10 years. Actually, more. I would zoom out to 20 or 30 or 40 year view on this at a minimum. So we went through a weird period in history where media is centralized. And that is like extraordinarily unusual. If you look at the scale of humanity, media was almost always local.
Right. And that's why I say in the history of book publishing, there was Gutenberg. We could almost skip over traditional book publishing and bookstores. And then there's kind of what you're doing, Amazon and so on. So like I skip over completely publishing because that was just a fluke almost.
Yeah. Well, but here's the thing. Media was centralized for about... Truly centralized, I would say for about, you can make an argument of somewhere between 80 and 150 years, right? So just call it 100 years. Media was centralized.
Right, because guys like Charles Dickens self-published.
Right. So centralization, if you look at the entire, look in the aggregate, we went from essentially tribes to an agrarian economy to an industrial economy, and we're coming out of that into a digital economy, right? And so in the industrial world, it made sense for everything to be bundled because there were economies of scale. That was the part of the tech evolution we were in. Going into a digital world, bundling doesn't make sense anymore because—
What do you mean by bundling?
I mean everything. Okay, so think about, what's a really easy example? Think about tools, right? Prior to let's just call it 1900. I'm being very rough here. So prior to 1900, if you wanted a tool, you went to the blacksmith in your town and he made it for you, right? After 1900, and again, very, very rough, tools were made in factories. Really, probably after World War One, tools were made in factories. Like no blacksmith was making a shovel anymore. Right? Why? Because you can make shovels faster, easier in factories. But it took a long time for the industrial corporatist world to develop and reach that sort of scale, right? But now it's like everything is a commodity, right? And physical goods are essentially all commodities, except for land. But but we're going back, I think, to we're not going to go backwards in terms of tech because nothing goes backwards. It all moves forward and things are recombined. We're going into a world where you can become local again, where you can be small scale, but still you can enjoy so many of the benefits of mass scale production, but humans are not designed to be parts of massive bureaucracies. We are not designed to be parts of big systems. We are designed to operate on a small scale in small groups that we all know and trust and respect. We're designed to have skin in the game with each other. That's the way socially we are designed, right? And I think everything mass and everything scale is breaking up. Media is in that phase, right? And so I think it's not that there's going to be micro brands. It's that everyone is going to, you're going to have maybe, the days of mass media are gone, dude. They're just gone.
Right,
and they're
and
not
I agree
coming
with that.
Back. And so what that means is it takes humans a long time to adapt to things, to tech, right? So what we're going to see is not even a million micro brands. It's going to be, I'll give you a good example. For professionals, if you are a high-level professional, let's just say, I'll make up a number to make it easy. If you make $500,000 or more, you're essentially going to have your own brand, your own professional brand, and your own media, right? You don't need a media company. You don't have to be James Altucher because you are a media person. If I'm a CEO coach, I don't need to be a media person. But what I do have to have is media, right? I have to have a book. I have to have maybe some video. I have to have at least, I don't have to have everything covered in all areas, but I have to have at least one or two major media areas covered that show my proof of work so that when CEOs need a coach, they're not going to the New York Times. They're not going because the mass doesn't exist. Right. They have to go look for people who are CEO coaches and then they have to pick the one. How are they going to pick, right? They have to pick based on proof of work. The days of certain people being the approved vendors of the large scale mass are gone. And so in media, you're going to see Godin and people like that are going to have a harder time being high end because there's no more mass. It won't exist anymore. The days of mass are gone, and you will see lots and lots and lots more of niche and niche and niche and niche, which is fine. That's the way humans work, man. It's better.
Right. So, but some people might be hearing this disappointed. Like they want to take, they're just interested in writing, let's say entertaining writing, and they have a voice and people like what they do. And they want to be mass.
Yeah.
What should they do?
Well, then that's an ego thing. That's their.
It is an ego
thing. No, that's their. Well, then, I mean, okay, if you want to live your life.
It's how you got your start. You were able to ride.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. Yeah. No, I'm not saying I don't fall in that category. I did definitely early on. Look, so here's the thing. I'm not saying mass is impossible, but I'm saying mass used to be there were one or two. The power curve was very, very steep and came down very quickly and there was almost no long tail. Now, so much of that has shifted and now the middle part, I think, is going to become a little bit fatter, but the long tail will become massively fatter, but will also sustain. So, like, if you want to become mass because, it depends what the goal is. If you want to be mass because you want to support yourself doing your art, that is now easier than it's ever been, and it's only going to get easier. If you want to become mass because you want to fill your empty fucking soul with a bunch of people staring at you, those days are over, and you're fucked.
And it brings up Kevin Kelly's 1,000 True Fans article, which is that you need whatever media you choose, whatever multiple media you choose, you need to really be good at expressing yourself in that medium.
Yes,
because loyalty rather than numbers are more important.
Yes.
Like, you can get a million views on something, but if it's all
garbage views, doesn't mean anything.
Right. Like which is a lot of, let's say, Instagram likes, or, you know, it's done by bots or whatever.
Right.
But if you have those 1,000 true fans, 2,000 true fans, 10,000 true fans, you're going to do well and have impact.
I could not agree more.
So, gosh, I feel like we've talked about so many topics. We could keep going. I could ask you for relationship advice next. what should I do next? You see me do all these things. What should I do next?
I don't know, dude. I don't know enough details. That's why I want to go get lunch
this podcast.
With you. Yeah. How do you what?
How do I make the podcast bigger? Podcast is already pretty big. How can I switch up format? I've been interviewing you for 5 years and 500 people
you. That's a really good question. So I'll tell you where I think podcasts are going. So your podcast interview style is mass media style.
Yeah.
I think that's going away. I think it's less and less.
There's 600,000 interview podcasts out there.
Right, exactly. And there's only so many people to interview and they all get the stupid rote answers and it's played out. I actually think the future of podcasting is what I was talking about, is experts, not even interviewing. They can be interview, whatever. It's experts displaying their expertise and teaching through podcast. So, like, I mean, you see Tim doing this a lot, right? Who's a friend of ours.
Yeah.
I think that mass media was all about disposable content. That world is, content doesn't have to be disposable anymore, man. Like, if you looked at podcasts as, I am going to record nuggets, not nuggets of wisdom, specific, like, you want to learn how to write a great blog post, I'll write a piece about it, and then I'm going to record a podcast about it, right? And it doesn't have to, you don't read the piece necessarily. It's much more about whatever. And then James Altucher's podcast on how to write a great blog post, let's say, that can be, because search for podcasts will improve. Like, discovery and search for podcasts is garbage now. That's going to improve. That's going to expand, I think, exponentially. And we're going to start seeing a lot of knowledge and wisdom contained in long tail stuff and podcasts.
I agree. And I think we've been gradually making the shift to that. It's almost like in the middle right now. Like we'll have on a celebrity guest and that almost status signals to other guests, oh, this is the type of podcast where he had X, Y, and Z. Okay, I'll go on there. But interestingly, those get the least number of views. Now they still get a lot of views, but less than the how to be this sort of podcasts.
Could not agree more, brother.
So listen, Scribe Media is great. I've always loved what you're doing, and I'm so glad you came on the podcast. I hate winding it down. Can we make this into a 2-part podcast, by the way?
Yeah, of course.
By the way. Do you know Steve Cohen? He's the podcast producer.
No, no. Hey, what's up? Nice to meet you.
You never had Tucker on Good Day New York?
No, we said.
He was a producer for TV for like 30 years.
Oh, wow.
On every morning show in New York.
Yeah. We definitely have. Yeah.
I mean, he also, Tucker, by the way, he ages everybody, not just you, me.
Yeah.
Producing. It was
30 years.
Your age, no, I'm saying, like,
everybody is my age, all right? And if you're not my age, you're catching up to me. Which, by the way, I just stole a Louis C.K. joke, right? He has Britney Spears used to be a teenager, and now Britney Spears is his age. That's like one of his jokes.
Oh, that's also like your favorite, Matthew McConaughey in Austin.
Yeah.
They keep getting younger.
I keep getting older, and they stay the same age, high school girls.
Yeah, like Matthew McConaughey is the same age he's been since Dazed and Confused. Yeah. So we should go to Austin. There's like 1,000 people in Austin to do on the podcast.
Happy to help you.
Do you know Richard Linklater?
No.
No, he's in Austin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, Tucker Max, once again, the 80th time you've been on the podcast. So much fun. I've learned so much stuff, and we've had so many interesting conversations. Come on again.
Thank you, brother.
Have you ever spotted McDonald's hot, crispy fries right as they're being scooped into the carton? And time just stands still. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.